Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Today we continue our conversation from last month on books set on or about the Cape and Islands. With us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And naturalist Dennis Minsky. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Mindy. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Dennis. I have to say I miss about being in the studio, given this is now our fifth time not in the studio, is just being able to chat with you both before we get going.
I know, yes. It's a very different world we're in right now. Well, last month we had this topic, and we just didn't get to a lot of the books, so decided to continue because there's so many great books we didn't managed to get in last month's show.
This is true, and I feel like we scratched the surface last month, and we will scratch it once again this month, because once you start looking, it's a very deep pool of writing about the Cape and Islands and by people who have passed through or live on the Cape and Islands. I actually wanted to start this morning with two short poems. I tried to pick only one because, you know, there's only so much poetry people can take in the morning. However, they are both so perfect for where we are right now, and they're both such two of my favorite Cape and Islands poets. I'm going to start with a poem by Marge Piercy from her book Stone, Paper, Knife, and it's called Very Late July. July in the afternoon, the sky rings, a crystal goblet without a crack. One gull passes over mewing for company. A tiger swallowtail hovers near magenta flocks, while a confetti cloud of fritillaries covers the golden glow. The sun lowers a helmet of flame over my skull till my brain cooks yellow as chicken skin. Beside me, half under the tent of my skirt, my cat blinks at the day, content watching, allowing the swallowtail to light within paw reach, purring too softly to be heard, only the vibration from his brown chest buzzing into my palm. Among the scarlet blossoms of the runner beans twinning on their tripods, the hummingbird darts like a jet fighter. Today, in think tanks, the data analysts, not on vacation, are playing war games. A worker is packing plutonium by remote control into new warheads. An advisor is telling the president as they golf, we could win it. July without a crack as we live inside the great world egg. Mm-hmm. So that's a little Marge Piercy for you this morning. And, of course, the wonderful Mary Oliver wrote this wonderful poem about starfish. In the sea rocks, in the stone pockets, under the tide's lip, in water dense as blindness, they slid like sponges, like too many thumbs. I knew this, and what I wanted was to draw my hands back from the water. What I wanted was to be willing to be afraid. But I stayed there. I crouched on the stone wall while the sea poured its harsh song through the sluices, while I waited for the gritty lightning of their touch, while I stared down through the tides leaving where sometimes I could see them, their stubborn flesh lounging on my knuckles. What good does it do to lie all day in the sun, loving what is easy? It never grew easy, but at last I grew peaceful. All summer my fear diminished as they bloomed through the water like flowers, like flecks of an uncertain dream, while I lay on the rocks, reaching into the darkness, learning little by little to love our only world. Mm-hmm. That is Starfish from Mary Oliver. So a couple poems to get us going
here. I think that's a great way to start the show. And we should mention, if listeners have a book that they'd like to recommend for our list this morning, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dennis, what are you going to start with this morning?
Well, I want to start out with a shout-out, first of all. Many of the books I'm going to talk about, Robert Finch recommended, so I thank him for that. I have a stack in front of me that I hope to talk about. I have a stack at my feet that I never got to. We could do a third show. I also want to give a shout-out to my library that never failed to find a book for me, no matter how old or how out of print. And lastly, a shout out to my 4-year-old and 7-year-old granddaughters sharing this space, and my wife, who gave me a little bit of time to read some of these books. So the great joy of these shows for me is discovery. And I finally met someone many of your readers will know, and Jill probably knows, you probably know, Joseph Lincoln.
Yes.
Great writer, quite prolific. He lived from 1870 to 1944, wrote dozens of books. And the one I want to talk about is Cape Cod Yesterdays. And he starts another book about Cape Cod. There are so many of them already. Another one, good heavens, why? And then he goes into the merits of many of the books already written. This is 1935, and how well researched they were, and so on. He says, this is not that kind of book. This is a fun book. He says, what has become of the old Cape cat boats? I can remember when 30 to 50 cats sailed out of Chatham Harbor for the fishing grounds every weekday morning. The gasoline engine ended all that, of course. All varieties of sailing craft are pretty nearly obsolete. So are many of the things that were common not so long ago. The old family carryalls and the blue truck wagons and the corner blacksmith shops and the fish flakes, the split cod drying in the sun. It's hard to get any hand-salted codfish nowadays. Everyone buys the stuff that comes in boxes or cartons, buys it at the local chain store. What has become of the old general store where you could buy everything from dress goods to molasses? Might as well ask, what has become of the old salts who used to sit on the benches outside those stores and spin yards? Or the retired sea captains? Every Cape town was full of them when I was a boy. Well, they were antiques then, and now we're getting to be antiques ourselves. Then each chapter is an experience in time. The first chapter is going to meeting. He talks about going to church. They call it the meeting house then. And, well, I'll go a little bit in that. It was very quiet along the main road. Not that the road was noisy even on a weekday, but on Sundays the hush was, to juvenile ears, almost painful. Grown-ups talked in subdued tones, and youth was not encouraged to talk at all. Occasionally a front gate opened to admit another group of churchgoers, the adults all in their best bibs and tuckers, and apparently satisfied to be so, and the children, the boys at least, as outwardly grand and inwardly rebellious as you were. Occasionally also a buggy or carryall passed at a decorous speed, bearing the more affluent, those financially able to keep a horse and team. Ahead, around the bend, on the general store, the church bell was ringing. No church bell in these modern times rings with such a commanding clang. I'm sure of that. And then he goes on to a trip to Boston, where it would take most of the day to get there. And now, he says, and now the Cape Codder and his wife breakfast in their own dining room, board their automobile, reach Boston shortly after the stores open, do their shopping, and are back home early again in the evening. He talks about...
Dennis, I think with the traffic, I think it's still... There's times it still can take you almost all day to get to Boston.
So he says, my native town, which he never mentions, by the way, to kind of keep this universal. My native town was perhaps 10 miles from Chatham in a straight line, about a 15-minute jog in a motor car nowadays. But then by rail and stagecoach, it was almost a day's journey. He talks about cranberry picking. To prove that I am not exaggerating the importance of the cranberry picking season on Cape Cod in those days, it's necessary only to mention its effect upon the schools. Now the Cape schools open early in September. Well, we'll see about that. But they did not do so then. To pay an upstairs teacher, I don't know what that means, the munificent salary of $60 a month to to instruct but a handful of scholars would have been a foolish waste. So the school committee set the opening day sometime during the first week in October. Picking was practically over by that time, and the young folk would be off the swamps. It was as important as that. And finally, I could go through riding an ox out to the fish weirs. Finally, and the tin peddler, dear, dear, why, the old-time tin peddler is extinct, isn't he? The local chain stores and the 5s and 10s have put him out of business, I suppose. The purchase of a new saucepan is no longer an important matter in itself. It is just one more item on the shopping list when one motors to Hyannis or New Bedford or Boston. So much more here. About fishing, about gunning, about hunting ducks and shorebirds. A real look at life, late 19th century, early 20th century Cape Cod. And the real message of this is people have always thought Cape Cod was special.
Yeah. And the name of the book again, Dennis?
This one is called Cape Cod Yesterdays, Joseph Lincoln,
right.
1935.
All right, Jill.
All right, so one of the pleasures, if one can call it that, seeing is, but, you know, it's everything that made you forget that we're in the middle of a pandemic was a good thing over the last few months, and that we started this in March and we're still doing this on the phone still amazes me. But one of the things that has brought me great pleasure is a online book club that I had not known about, and I probably came across it because Elizabeth McCracken was talking about it, and I follow Elizabeth McCracken on Twitter. And it is a book club that is run by a publisher called A Public Space. And A Public Space is an independent nonprofit publisher, and they publish a magazine, an arts and culture magazine, and they also publish public space books. Their mission being, as they say it, to publish writing from beyond established confines. So they started out, they were reading War and Peace together. Now, I had read War and Peace a couple of times, but I thought, oh, great, there's, you know, a whole group of people reading War and Peace. This is going to be exciting. And they had a hashtag Tolstoy Together, and everybody, utterly impressed by all the people that were reading it. I never got to the end again, but, you know, I knew what was going to happen, so that was sort of okay. However, they have then gone on to shorter things, and they now have a book group that they're calling APS Together rather than Tolstoy Together. And the book that they are currently reading, which I am astonished I had never read before, and how this is possible, I don't know, but it is called The Maitrees by Annie Dillard. It is a novel set in Provincetown, and Elizabeth McCracken is actually the person who's sort of leading the group this time. And as I say, I'm a big fan of Elizabeth McCracken, back to The Giant's House, which of course features a public librarian. Why would I not love Elizabeth McCracken, who used to work in libraries, be a librarian? And she describes The Maitrees. And again, this book was a revelation to me, and they're still reading it bit by bit. I actually decided I had to read to the end. But what she writes about it is, like all of my favorite books, The Maitrees is hard to describe. Its plot is time, really, but it's about empathy and marriage and divorce and love and the consolations of art. It begins with the courtship of Lou Bigelow and Toby Maitree, who marry and move to Provincetown and become the eponymous Maitrees. Other Maitrees follow, and it's full of remarkable characters and remarkable sentences. Some slim novels are spare and clean. I love those, too. But The Maitrees is crammed full like an old New England house filled with gewgaws and books and bric-a-brac. Above all, it is an intensely beautiful book. And I couldn't agree more with her. And I have to tell you, one of the great pleasures of reading this novel, and it's just so lusciously written. And so there is a plot, and the plot, you know, but actually the writing so sort of overshadows the plot. I can't, and apparently the book was originally quite a bit longer than it is now. So it's a quick read in some ways, but you just want to sort of float along in the book because it's so, the language is so beautiful. And one of the things that Annie Dillard does quite beautifully are lists, and I don't know why, but I love lists in novels. There are lots of them. Here's one that she has. In thin oil, she depicted clumsy beaches and clouds. Their foregrounds and middle ground showed jetsam and wreck, stained waves, brown bottles, steamer shells, broken china, waxed paper, church keys, foil, nails sticking through in lumber, clamshells, tires, purses, shoes, only two or three objects on each canvas. So I'm just a fan of that list. But also, may I say, Dennis and Mindy, thank you for teaching me last month what the word rack means. So therefore,
for the rack line, yeah.
I can't believe you didn't know that. I know, but I was so happy that reading this novel. You know, you guys had saved me last month. So she also has this gorgeous description of the night sky. And anybody, I can remember the first time I spent a night on Nantucket and went down to the beach, and I had never in my life seen as many stars. And I mean, I live in Falmouth, but there's a lot. I live downtown Falmouth. There's a lot of light around us. Nantucket on the beach, the stars were just glorious.
Oh, it's fabulous. It's you're right about that. Yeah.
It is breathtaking. So here's a little bit about stars at night, the night sky. When Maitri was young, men, women, and children found their way in starlight alone. When clouds covered the night sky, as now, the whole Cape knew it. Dark night, they said in a greeting then, as common and almost as frequent as fine day. The answer was, sure is, or real dark night. Night was their familiar parlor, a scented time all its own. Now that electric lights wrecked the night sky, he mourned as if the great universe had died within his own lifetime. People forgot to look up. Maitri knew his remembering starry nights dated him as the war did, except that the war, unlike human sight of stars, had lasted fewer than 10 years. So she has these great descriptions, and the story is, you know, set in Provincetown, although at one point some of the characters head off to Maine, but, you know, I don't want to give anything more away in terms of the plot, but I do think, and they're still reading this on a public space, so you certainly can join the group of readers and comment, and they also have just very brilliant people who comment on the books and add their own ideas about what's happening in the book. The book itself is called The Maitris by Annie Dillard, and you can find the book group at APS Together, a public space.
All right. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books set on or about the Cape and Islands with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and naturalist Dennis Minsky. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add something to our list. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I want to mention two Cape authors. I don't know if either of you have brought any of their books, but Lauren Walk, who wrote The Bright Blue Sea, Wolf Hollow, and Echo Mountain. She's just a wonderful writer, I think. And I'm always kind of puzzled that they put her in the young adult category, but I can assure you, you don't feel like you're reading a young adult book when you're reading her stuff. Jill, have you read any of her work?
I have, and I agree with you. It's odd that they put, I'm not quite sure why they do that, but presumably to get more readers.
but her work is just really wonderful, and I think you can't go wrong with any. Another one that I really love is Martin Sandler, and Marty. A lot of his books are sort of history based. Again, most of his books are geared to young adult, but he never talks down to children in his books, so it really is of interest, I think, for all ages. He's another one who really spans it. And I can't even tell you, he's written something like, you know, 60 books, but any one of his books is worth it. He's a real interesting read as well. All right, Dennis, what have you got next?
Well, I meant to read The Maitris, by the way, but I didn't, so.
You need to. You need to, Dennis.
I will. I'm keeping with my history theme, and the next book I'll talk about is Time in the Town, at Provincetown Chronicle, Mary Heaton Vorse. The year is 1942. And again, she's writing about the early 20th century. She was a journalist, had a pink tinge to her, I think, a bit of a leftist, union organizer, that sort of thing. But she's, I'll let her speak for herself. When she arrives in Provincetown, it was a seafaring place that lived from the sea and by the sea, and whose one crop was fish. When I drove around the town in a horse-drawn accommodation, I knew that here was home, that I wanted to live here always. Nor have I changed my mind in these 35 years, nor for one moment wished to live anywhere else, though I have been over half the globe. And then the book is an examination of Provincetown. Now, she talks about the one crop being fish. She talks about fishermen. Men for a living must have an easy courage. A good seaman cannot spend his time doubting himself. If you have an inferiority complex in the face of a storm, you get drowned. Men in Provincetown, people disciplined by the sea enjoy life. Intimate with this, with the seasons, they are aware every hour of the day. There never was a man with his good animal instincts intact who lacked either playfulness or dignity. Men grow well in Provincetown, at the garages, in the business places, on the wharves, and on the street. There are men who look as if they owned their world. On the other hand, there is no year when the sea has not yet drowned some of our men. And she quotes one fisherman who says, "I can't yet set foot on a drowned man in the dark without getting a shiver." Nice image, that. Moving on, Province sounds like an onion. There is here layer on layer, whorl on whorl. Three civilizations have met here and formed a unique strain. The old New Englanders, the Portuguese, and the summer folk have made a town individual in the world. Layers of different cultures are superimposed one upon the other, yet each layer exists as part and parcel of the whole. There are summer people owning houses who yet are counted as summer people. There are art students, actors, and writers who come to do serious work. Transient summer visitors, the vacationers, people off on a good time, who come to Provincetown with an idea that here anything goes, make up yet another world. This is in 1912 she's writing about. So she moves on. She takes a trip to Nantucket. So of all the towns on our coast, the prize for high perfection belongs to Nantucket. So you Nantucketers out there should feel pretty This town is like some beautiful old woman sitting dreaming in a garden. There are no motors there, okay? But Nantucket does not earn her living anymore, and summer people, off-islanders, keep her alive. Already in 1917, 2,000 people live there in winter and 13,000 in summer. The summer people cherish Nantucket tenderly, so on and so forth. A place, here's her lecture. A place like a person which does not earn its own living lacks moral stamina. And where the minority of the population lives on the majority, there is an atmosphere that's negative. So Nantucketers, and then she says that's a corrective for Provincetown, you know, that place that doesn't earn its own living. Later on, she says, people say Provincetown has changed. This is in 1922, at least in the last few years. The real change, the deep spiritual change, happened long ago. It had to do with the automobile. Directly after the war, everybody took to wheels. But we in Provincetown were still cut off, more accessible by sea. Long, sandy, winding roads kept motorists away. Now the state road has come through. Cars had come to Provincetown, and there was a never-ending line of them. Sounds familiar. Horns honked. Loudspeakers blared on the front street. The town looked as if it were a costume ball. And in 1922, the summer crowd had come to stay. And I won't go into all the quotes, but she talks about how they have irrevocably changed the town. Provincetown, whose one crop was fish, now has another crop, tourists. There's a different mentality to the town. The whole town had become a rooming house. The town is checkered with small and desperate trades. The hot breath of honky-tonk, which with the coming of tourists blows over the town from July 4th to Labor Day. She refers to the knick-knack industry. Finally, she says a few people have been allowed to damage the beauty of Provincetown. It's been taken over by outsiders and trivial little shops. So once again, nothing changes. This is written in 1942. It's about the beginning of the 20th century, and all the same complaints existed then that exist now.
Exist today, yeah. What's the name of the book again?
Time and the Town, A Provincetown Chronicle. Beautiful book. I didn't even get to any of her references to the Portuguese. She was highly fond of the Portuguese. And there's so much more in this book that I didn't get to.
Yeah, you can't get it all in it, that's for sure.
Book if you're interested in the history of the Cape.
Yeah. Irene from Wellfleet writes, I'd like to recommend The Wild Edge, Life and Lore of the Great Atlantic Beaches by Philip Copper. This book includes more of the shore than Cape Cod, but it is chock full of information written in a more entertaining way than the most books on this subject. One review describes it as an encyclopedic but loving description of the seashore, and I think captures the feeling of the book by adding the descriptions that are written with an underlying twinkle in the author's eye. It's an older book written in 1979. She says, I assume it's out of print but can be found through the library system or inexpensively secondhand. So thank you, Irene, for that suggestion. If you have a suggestion for us, 866-999-4626. Our topic today is books set on or about the Cape and Islands. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jill, what's next?
My next book is actually a sketchbook. It is something I found on the shelves when browsing, and it's funny, speaking of browsing, I have been talking to a lot of patrons lately because for about an hour every morning now, I go outside and talk to the people who are waiting in line to pick up books from the library because we have a table out front, and so I chat with them, and this one fellow started talking, and not just this one fellow, pretty much every single person in the line, what they most miss is browsing in the library. Mm. It's not the books themselves, it's not the CDs, the magazines, it's browsing. Yeah. And this one fellow went on and he just did this like eloquent speech about how he particularly browses and how wonderful it is to browse. And I have to agree with him. And I found these books. It's two books. It's one with images, the other with text. I found them browsing Martha's Vineyard and Other Places, my third sketchbook from the summer of 1982 by David Hockney. I don't know how. I had never seen these before, but they're fabulous. The drawings, one volume, as I say, is his actual sketches. The other is a description and a commentary on the sketches he has made. There are only a few of them that are set on the vineyard, actually. In the book section, he writes, I had flown to Martha's Vineyard in a small plane. It's an island, and there is the sea all around you. In this drawing, I'm probably looking out of a window at the roof. I draw that first, then I probably stop. I didn't carry on with the drawing, but then later on, I made it into a kind of map, but an aerial view. And he goes on to talk about sort of the process of sketching, but also particularly Cape Cod. He writes, the idea for the map came from an actual map of Cape Cod Bay, which happened to be under a pile of books. That is when I went back and altered the original drawing. I also added the ferry boat that brings the cars, and then you were back on the sea. So you're getting different points of view. That is how the drawing grows. And he is talking in this book as much about the process of drawing as he is the particular images. He writes about his sketchbooks. Sketchbooks are like diaries, and like diaries, they are private, drawing in private. Of all the things an artist does, drawing is the most personal, and keeping a sketchbook is like that. Sketchbooks are not made with the intention of publishing them. They're made just to note something down. They can record emotions as well as events. They record one's feelings of a place. Also, they record different ways of looking at something. For instance, in this sketchbook, there are different ways of looking at the house where I had been staying on Martha's Vineyard, an old wooden house. I was struck by the fact that it was all wood that goes gray because of the salt in the air. So there are many drawings all about wood. that is your feeling. That you suddenly notice it's all about wood. Anyway, he goes on and on about his various drawings in the book. The drawings themselves are beautiful. I have no idea. Let me see. I do have some idea when this was published, but it says that it's his third sketchbook. I don't know if sketchbooks one and two were also done, and this is, again, 1982. But it's a really interesting look at how artists work, and as well as some beautiful drawings of the vineyard itself. The book, again, Martha's Vineyard and Other Places, by David Hockney.
Right. Dennis, what have you got?
Well, I'm going to stay on the history theme, and because whales are part of my life, I hope they are anyhow. I have a really wonderful book I discovered years ago called Cape Cod Shore Whaling, America's First Whalemen. John Braginton Smith and Duncan Oliver. It's published in 2008. And it's a small book, very nicely done, it's a good book. It describes the origins of whaling, which was shore whaling, and the origins of shore whaling was drift whales. That is, back when we had probably 100 times more whales than we have today, you had living whales, so you had whales that would die and drift ashore. Now, the Native Americans used these whales for food, but it was the early colonists who began to try the blubber for oil. Cape Codders were the first to try whale blubber. Long Islanders made it a business, and, of course, Nantucketers made it a national industry. But in this book, it documents that almost every man on the Cape was involved in some aspect of whaling, and even if you weren't, whale oil supplemented education, and it also paid for the ministers. And the side effects of whaling included deforestation. Read this a little bit. Coopers were vital to this operation, for whale oil had to be put in barrels. When Plymouth became part of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, almost immediately a law was passed regarding this issue. That is to say, butts, B-U-T-T-S, butts to contain 126 gallons, puncheons 84 gallons, and so on and so on, each made of sound, well-seasoned timber and free of sap. And every cooper shall set his distinct brand mark on his own cask. Interestingly, the buttery room of a Cape house was not where butter was stored. Rather, it was where these large barrels were stored, thus giving rise to the word butter. Wood was used to start the fires. At any rate, according to them, Great Island in Wellfleet was completely devoid of wood by 1711. 1711, no more trees. In 1714, the General Court created the province land and regulated the taking of wood with specific reference to erosion and sand filling the harbor. Also, we think of the heyday of whaling, but by 1720, whales were becoming scarce. Ships began to go offshore worldwide. In 1720, in 1737, only two whales were killed in Provincetown. In 1755, only three houses were left, and by the end of the Revolution, there was no population in Provincetown at all. There's quite a bit of really interesting information here about the heyday of whaling, the surprising lack of whales early on, and, of course, the effect on culture and on the environment of whaling. Right. So I highly recommend this book to anyone who's interested in the history of Cape Cod. It's very well documented and very well written.
And the name again?
Cape Cod Shore Whaling, America's First Whalemen.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking a book about books set on or about the Cape and Islands with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and naturalist Dennis Minsky. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. A listener suggests In the Wake of the Willows, the sequel to The Wind in the Willows. Listener says, even though the book isn't based on Cape Cod, it evokes a feeling of Cape Cod, but the author is based in Cape Cod, Frederick Thurber, and it's illustrated by his wife, Amy Thurber. We had them on The Point recently, if you want to check the archives for that. And that is a lovely book. Thank you for that suggestion. That's a great one. I have another suggestion that kind of popped in my mind. And this book was out in 2005, and it was one of the funniest things I've ever read. So if you're looking for something that'll give you a laugh, it's Craig Kingsbury Talking, The Salty Model for Quint Speaks Out. And of course, Craig Kingsbury lived in Martha's Vineyard. And I will tell you, the book is very salty, written by his daughter, Kristen Kingsbury Henshaw. And when the book came out and we booked Kristen to come on the show, I hadn't read the whole book yet. So tears are running down my face as I'm reading this, but I'm going, oh, we can't tell that story on the air. Can't tell that story on there. So she did a fantastic job of being able to tell these very salty stories in a way that we were able to put them on the air. But it's really quite funny. Have either of you read that book?
I have not.
I will now.
Yeah. Oh, boy, was he a character. And I guess he used to answer the phone that way. Craig Kingsbury Talking. But, yeah, if you want to laugh, it's a it's.
I definitely have In the Wake of the Willows on my top of my stack now.
Yes, Dennis, you will love that book. Absolutely, for sure. All right, Jill, I think you're up next.
I am. Okay. I did want to mention that, in fact, Elizabeth McCracken's, because I think I neglected to mention this, Elizabeth McCracken's novel, The Giant's House, is actually set in a Brewster-like town, and was actually, The Guardian called it one of the overlooked classics of American literature, and I don't think that's just because there's a great librarian in it, but it could be. In fact, she has this great little sentence here: librarian, like stewardess, certified public accountant, used car salesman, is one of those occupations that people assume attract a certain formed personality. Librarians are supposed to be bitter spinsters, grudging, lonely, and above all stingy. We love our fine money, our silence. I did not love fine money. I forgave much more than I collected. I did not shush people unless they yelled. And though I was technically a spinster, I was bitter only insofar as people made me. It isn't that bitter people become librarians. It's that being a librarian may turn the most giving person bitter. We are paid all day to be generous, and no one recognizes our generosity. Although I have to say right now, a lot of people are recognizing our generosity.
Yeah.
But yes, The Giant's House, and another book that I was wanted to mention, which is another novel. And this one I had asked on Twitter last month about people who might, you know, what novels did they love set on Cape Cod. And Mary Bergman, who sometimes is on the Cape Cod Notebook on WCAI, yep, sent a note to me, and she said, I read a lot of Cape Cod books, and it's hard to find books about the real people who live here. So many books about the trope of the second home when the people who live here can't even afford one home. The House on Oyster Creek by Heidi John Schmidt is my favorite Cape Cod book because it's about the year-round community. So that's another title you might take a look at, The House on Oyster Creek. And I would be remiss to not mention Illumination Night by Alice Hoffman, which I think is probably one of the first Cape Cod books I read. I myself am deeply missing Illumination Night this week. Last summer, for the first time, Matt and I actually got to go to Illumination Night, and I had always wanted to, but the ferry was, you know, always leaving. We had to come home. But we stayed. We stayed the night, and it's just the novel itself starts in a house that has a couple and their child, and there's an elderly woman who lives next door. Simon is their 4-year-old, and as it says, Simon is in his fourth year and small even for his age when he sees white-robed Elizabeth Rennie, a neighbor in her 75th, tumble out her attic window like a cloud. So the two families get involved with one another, and they're also some just beautiful descriptions of what Illumination Night is like. Here she writes, Alice Huffman writes, it is the first week in August, and Simon is so excited he can't sleep during his afternoon nap. Instead, he crawls under the thin quilt with a flashlight. His mother had told him that Illumination Night is like thousands of fireflies. For more than 100 years, since Oak Bluffs was a Methodist camp with believers' tents set beneath the old enormous trees, there has been a grand illumination once a year. The Victorian cottage that ring Trinity Park are hung with Japanese lanterns lit by candles illuminated all at once by a signal from within the tabernacle in the center of the park. And if you have never been to Illumination Night, this is a lovely novel to read. And if you have, it might be a nice memory for you to read. This year, apparently, it will not be happening. The characters, it's just a very lovely novel about marriage troubles and troubles with children and people stuck in houses. So it really sort of seems like the perfect novel to read right now. Illumination Night by Alice Huffman.
All right. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I agree with you about Craig's book, Christie's book about her father. Yeah. I was one of his caregivers. And I just have a short story to tell you. He was a very brilliant man, very well educated. But anyway, one day I was taking care of him, and one of the sheep had a baby. And he said, would you go out in the pasture and get the baby and bring it in the barn? And I said, well, what's the mother going to do to me? He said, oh, she won't do anything. So he was right. I went out and picked up this very young baby lamb and took it in the barn, and the mother just followed me in. That was just one of the Craig stories. There's lots of them, you know.
Oh, yes.
Okay, bye.
Yeah. She did a great with that book. Thank you for calling, Jen. Appreciate that. And Peter in Yarmouth says he has two books, A Cape Cod Sketchbook by Mr. Jack Frost, 1939. Many of the structures he sketched are still standing today. The other book, That Quail Robert by Margaret A. Stanger, 1966, drawings by Kathy Baldwin. This true story is set in Orleans. Peter, thanks for those suggestions. And I should mention, all of the books that we talk about and the suggestions we get will be, we'll have a link to all of that later this afternoon on our website, capeandislands.org. Dennis, what have you got next?
Well, I see the time is running out, so I want to make sure that I mention a very, very important book. Last time we talked, I talked about Thoreau, I talked about Henry Beston, and I talked about our own Robert Finch. A name that must be included in that list is John Hay.
I knew you were going to say that.
I have a book here, Nature's Year, The Seasons of Cape Cod, which Bob Finch recommended to me of the many of his works, of Hay's works. The Woodcuts by David Gross are worth the book itself, and the writing is simply beautiful. And finally, because I don't know how much time I have, another book that Bob recommended is called The House on Nauset Marsh by Wyman Richardson, 1955. Dr. Wyman Richardson lived the busy life of a distinguished physician and taught at Harvard Medical School, but his Cape Cod was really important to him, and this house on Nauset Marsh is where he wrote a beautiful, intimate book about what it was like to live there. He was a big hunter, big fisherman, and the details of how to rig an eel, how to go crabbing, the best way to shoot a black duck, all of this is in here, and it's really a very, as I say, intimate. You really get a feeling that you've been there when you read this book. So I wanted to make sure I get those two books in.
Okay. Jill, what have you got?
Well, I wanted to make sure I got Sally Gunning's Mysteries in, because everybody knows Sally Gunning for her later work, but a lot of people may not know. The first one was written in 1990. It was called Hot Water, and it introduces Neshtoba, which is essentially Cape Cod, and Peter Bartholomew. Peter finds the body of Edna Hitchcock and is convinced that she was murdered, although someone tried to make it look like a suicide. And I don't understand why these aren't still in print. The only one that is still in print, as far as I can tell, is the 10th one, Firewater, which came out in 1999. But they're very funny, and the beginning of this one is very funny. They're all very funny, but here's just a taste of it. Peter Bartholomew was having a bad day. He looked at the dead woman floating in the tub, lolling in the tub, and tried to remember how much he hadn't liked her the first time he had met her, the day she'd hired him. It didn't help things much. He went into the usual adrenaline-inspired motions. He hauled the slippery, slimy, too white flesh out of the water and onto the floor, sloshing buckets of water across the yellow tiles and out into the hall. She appeared to be dead, very dead. Her face was an odd color. There were dark bruise-like spots along her backside, and she wasn't exactly what you would call limp. But why was she so warm? He left her there on the floor and backed down the stairs to the hall phone to call the emergency number Jean. The dispatcher answered, another bad sign. This is Peter Bartholomew. Pete, I was just trying to call you at your office. Is that where you are? Your line was busy. I have got to have my windows cleaned. And guess who I saw this morning? Connie. Peter Bartholomew was suddenly overcome by a fast-moving strain of exhaustion. He sank down onto the bottom stair. Why was everyone so anxious today to tell him his wife was back? This is an emergency, Jean. I'm at the Hitchcock place. Where? Denault. The Denault place. The dead woman, Edna Denault, had become Edna Hitchcock at least 30 or 40 years before. But just try to tell anyone on this island that, especially Jean, especially when you were trying to get her to turn around and holler over her shoulder to the fire department to get the rescue wagon out fast to this house. You can get a sense that they're both funny. He's funniness, but they're also, there is, you know, a crime that gets solved in the course of them. And they all involve, every title has to do with water. It goes hot water, underwater, ice water, rough water, et cetera, et cetera. You can still find them in some public libraries. This one happens to be a sort of beat up paperback from the Woods Hole Public Library, but you can find them still. And I urge you to do so. Try Sally Gunning's Mysteries. There's a whole series. And also Philip Craig's. If you haven't read any of Philip Craig's, the first one is A Beautiful Place to Die. It's set in the vineyard. And as some reviewer wrote, you know, it's more about the vineyard than it is about the mystery. And that's sort of true. But he writes so beautifully. And there actually was this great obit in which they wrote, and while they never achieved literary acclaim, Philip Craig's book had no need of it because their appeal lay in their readability, their power of escape, and their keen sense of place. The author not only created characters that were agreeable and plots with just enough twist to pique the reader, he always got the vineyard right, which is not true of all books we read about the vineyard, I have no doubt. So if you have never read his books, you should certainly start with A Beautiful Place to Die. And they, of course, some were written after he died, because that often is what happens with mystery writers. But
he also included recipes. You remember the recipes in his stories?
That's
right. And then I think he even did a book of that was recipes from his mysteries.
I think it was called Delish,
if I'm remembering.
Yeah.
Good suggestions. And I would say also check out Sally Gunning's latest works too, Widow's War, Monticello. I mean, she's got just all of, I love her work. She's another one of my favorites. We will have a link, as I mentioned, to the books we talk about this morning up at our website, capeandislands.org. We're going to give Jill a little bit of time to put that together. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and naturalist Dennis Minsky. Thank you both for your suggestions. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you, Mindy. Jill.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.